Chapter 7, The War of the Gods and Demons. The materialist theory of history, that all politics and ethics are the expression of economics, is a very simple fallacy indeed. It consists simply of confusing the necessary conditions of life with the normal preoccupations of life that are quite a different thing. It is like saying that because a man can walk about on two legs, therefore he never walks about except to buy shoes and stockings. Man cannot live without the two props of food and drink which support him like two legs, but to suggest that they have been the motives of all his movements in history is like saying that the goal of all his military marches or religious pilgrimages must have been the golden leg of Miss Kilmansegg or the ideal and perfect leg of Sir Willoughby Patterne. That it is such movements that make up the story of mankind, and without them there would practically be no story at all. Cows may be purely economic in the sense that we cannot see that they do much beyond grazing and seeking better grazing grounds. That is why a history of cows in 12 volumes would not be very lively reading. Sheep and goats may be pure economists in their external action at least, but that is why the sheep has hardly been a hero of epic wars and empires thought worthy of detailed narration, and even the more active quadruped has not inspired a book for boys called Golden Deeds of Gallant Goats, or any similar title. But so far from the movements that make up the story of man being economic, we may say that the story only begins where the motive of the cows and sheep leaves off. It will be hard to maintain that the Crusaders went from their homes into a howling wilderness because cows go from a wilderness to a more comfortable grazing ground. It will be hard to maintain that the Arctic explorers went north with the same material motive that made the swallows go south. And if you leave things like all the religious wars and all the merely adventurous explorations out of the human story, it will not only cease to be human at all, but cease to be a story at all. The outline of history is made from these decisive curves and angles determined by the will of man. Economic history would not even be history. But there is a deeper fallacy besides this obvious fact, that men need not live for food merely because they cannot live without food. The truth is that the thing most present to the mind of man is not the economic machinery necessary to his existence, but rather that existence itself, the world which he sees when he wakes every morning, and the nature of his general position in it. There is something that is nearer to him than livelihood, and that is life. For once that he remembers exactly what work produces his wages and exactly what wages produce his meals, he reflects 10 times that it is a fine day, or it is a queer world, or wonders whether life is worth living, or wonders whether marriage is a failure, or is pleased and puzzled with his own children, or remembers his own youth, or in any such fashion vaguely reviews the mysterious lot of man. This is true of the majority, even of the wage slaves of our morbid modern industrialism, which by its hideousness and inhumanity has really forced the economic issue to the front. It is immeasurably more true of the multitude of peasants or hunters or fishers who make up the real mass of mankind. Even those dry pedants who think that ethics depend on economics must admit that economics depend on existence. And any number of normal doubts and daydreams are about existence, not about how we can live, but about why we do. And the proof of it is simple as suicide. Turn the universe upside down in the mind, and you turn all the political economists upside down with it. Suppose that a man wishes to die, and the professor of political economy becomes rather a bore with his elaborate explanations of how he is to live. And all the departures and decisions that make our human past into a story have this character of diverting the direct course of pure economics. As the economist may be excused from calculating the future salary of a suicide, so he may be excused from providing an old age pension for a martyr As he need not provide for the future of a martyr, so he need not provide for the family of a monk. His plan is modified in lesser and varying degrees by a man being a soldier and dying for his own country, by a man being a peasant and specially loving his own land, by a man being more or less affected by any religion that forbids or allows him to do this or that. But all these come back not to an economic calculation about livelihood, but to an elemental outlook upon life. They all come back to what a man fundamentally feels when he looks forth from those strange windows which we call the eyes, and upon that strange vision that we call the world. No wise man will wish to bring more long words into the world, but it may be allowable to say that we need a new thing, which may be called psychological history. I mean the consideration of what things meant in the mind of a man, especially an ordinary man, as distinct from what is defined or deduced merely from official forms or political pronouncements. I have already touched on it in such a case as the totem or indeed any other popular myth. It is not enough to be told that a tomcat was called a totem, especially when it was not called a totem. We want to know what it felt like. Was it like Whittington's cat or like a witch's cat? Was its real name Pasht or Puss in Boots? That is the sort of thing we need, touching the nature of political and social relations. We want to know the real sentiment that was the social bond of many common men, as sane and as selfish as we are. What did soldiers feel when they saw splendid in the sky that strange totem that we call the golden eagle of the legions? What did vassals feel about those other totems, the lions or the leopards upon the shield of their lord? So long as we neglect this subjective side of history, which may more simply be called the inside of history, there will always be a certain limitation on that science which can be better transcended by art. So long as the historians cannot do that, fiction will be truer than fact. There will be more reality in a novel, yes, even in a historical novel. In nothing is this new history needed so much as in the psychology of war. Our history is stiff with official documents, public or private, which tell us nothing of the thing itself. At the worst, we only have the official posters, which could not have been spontaneous precisely because they were official. At the best, we have only the secret diplomacy, which could not have been popular precisely because it was secret. Upon one or other of these is based the historical judgment about the real reasons that sustain the struggle. Governments fight for colonies or commercial rights. Governments fight about harbors or high tariffs. Governments fight for a gold mine or a pearl fishery. It seems sufficient to answer that governments do not fight at all. Why do the fighters fight? What is the psychology that sustains the terrible and wonderful thing called war? Nobody who knows anything of soldiers believes the silly notion of the Dons that millions of men can be ruled by force. If they were all too slack, it would be impossible to punish all the slackers. And the least little touch of slacking would lose a whole campaign in half a day. What did men really feel about the policy? If it can be said that they accepted the policy from the politician, what did they feel about the politician? If the vassals warred blindly for their prince, what did those blind men see in their prince? There is something we all know which can only be rendered in an appropriate language as realpolitik. As a matter of fact, it is an almost insanely unreal politik. It is always stubbornly and stupidly repeating that men fight for material ends without reflecting for a moment that the material ends are hardly ever material to the men who fight. In any case, no man will die for practical politics, just as no man will die for pay. Nero could not hire 100 Christians to be eaten by lions at a shilling an hour. for men will not be martyred for money. But the vision called up by real politic or realistic politics is beyond example, crazy, and incredible. Does anybody in the world believe that a soldier says, "My leg is nearly dropping off, but I shall go on till it drops, for after all I shall enjoy all the advantages of my government obtaining a warm water port in the Gulf of Finland"? Can anybody suppose that a clerk turned conscript says, "If I am gassed, I shall probably die in torments, but it is a comfort to reflect that should I ever decide to become a pearl diver in the South Seas, that career is now open to me and my countrymen"? Materialist history is the most madly incredible of all histories, or even of all romances. Whatever starts wars, the thing that sustains wars is something in the soul. That is something akin to religion. It is what men feel about life and about death. A man near to death is dealing directly with an absolute. It is nonsense to say he is concerned only with relative and remote complications that death in any case will end. If he is sustained by certain loyalties, they must be loyalties as simple as death. They are generally two ideas which are only two sides of one idea. The first is the love of something said to be threatened, if it be only vaguely known as home. The second is dislike and defiance of some strange thing that threatens it. The first is far more philosophical than it sounds, though we need not discuss it here. A man does not want his national home destroyed or even changed because he cannot even remember all the good things that go with it, just as he does not want his house burnt down because he can hardly count all the things he would miss. Therefore, he fights for what sounds like a hazy abstraction but is really a house. But the negative side of it is quite as noble as well as quite as strong. Men fight hardest when they feel that the foe is at once an old enemy and an eternal stranger, that his atmosphere is alien and antagonistic, as the French feel about the Prussian or the Eastern Christians about the Turk. If we say it is a difference of religion, people will drift into dreary bickerings about sects and dogmas. We will pity them and say it is a difference about death and daylight, a difference that does really come like a dark shadow between our eyes and the day. Men can think of this difference even at the point of death, for it is a difference about the meaning of life. Men are moved in these things by something far higher and holier than policy, by hatred. When men hung on in the darkest days of the Great War, suffering either in their bodies or in their souls for those they loved, they were long past caring about details of diplomatic objects as motives for their refusal to surrender. Of myself and those I knew best, I can answer for the vision that made surrender impossible. It was the vision of the German Emperor's face as he rode into Paris. This is not the sentiment which some of my idealistic friends describe as love. I am quite content to call it hatred, the hatred of hell and all its works, and to agree that, as they do not believe in hell, they need not believe in hatred. But in the face of this prevalent prejudice, this long introduction has been unfortunately necessary to ensure an understanding of what is meant by a religious war. There is a religious war when two worlds meet, that is, when two visions of the world meet, or in more modern language, when two moral atmospheres meet. What is the one man's breath is the other man's poison, and it is vain to talk of giving a pestilence a place in the sun. And this is what we must understand, even at the expense of digression, if we would see what really happened in the Mediterranean, when right athwart the rising of the Republic on the Tiber, a thing overtopping and disdaining it dark with all the riddles of Asia and trailing all the tribes and dependencies of imperialism, came Carthage riding on the sea. The ancient religion of Italy was, on the whole, that mixture which we have considered under the head of mythology. save that where the Greeks had a natural turn for the mythology, the Latins seem to have had a real turn for religion. Both multiplied gods, yet they sometimes seem to have multiplied them for almost opposite reasons. It would seem sometimes as if the Greek polytheism branched and blossomed upwards like the boughs of a tree, while the Italian polytheism ramified downward like the roots. Perhaps it would be truer to say that the former branches lifted themselves lightly bearing flowers, while the latter hung down being heavy with fruit. I mean that the Latins seemed to multiply gods to bring them nearer to men, while the Greek gods rose and radiated outwards into the morning sky. What strikes us in the Italian cults is their local and especially their domestic character. We gain the impression of divinities swarming about the house like flies, of deities clustering and clinging like bats about the pillars or building like birds under the eaves. We have a vision of a god of roofs and a god of gateposts, of a god of doors and even a god of drains. It has been suggested that all mythology was a sort of fairy tale. But this was a particular sort of fairy tale which may truly be called a fireside tale or a nursery tale, because it was a tale of the interior of the home, like those which make chairs and tables talk like elves. The old household gods of the Italian peasants seem to have been great, clumsy wooden images, more featureless than the figurehead which Quilp battered with the poker. This religion of the home was very homely. Of course, there were other, less human elements in the tangle of Italian mythology. There were Greek deities superimposed on the Roman. There were here and there uglier things underneath, experiments in the cruel kind of paganism, like the Arician rite of the priest slaying the slayer. That these things were always potential in paganism, they are certainly not the peculiar character of Latin paganism. The peculiarity of that may be roughly covered by saying that if mythology personified the forces of nature, this mythology personified nature as transformed by the forces of man. It was the god of the corn and not of the grass, of the cattle and not the wild things of the forest. In short, the cult was literally a culture, as when we speak of it as agriculture. With this, there was a paradox which is still for many the puzzle or riddle of the Latins. With religion running through every domestic detail like a climbing plant, there went what seems to many the very opposite spirit, the spirit of revolt. Imperialists and reactionaries often invoke Rome as the very model of order and obedience, but Rome was the very reverse. The real history of ancient Rome is much more like the history of modern Paris. It might be called in modern language a city built out of barricades. It is said that the gate of Janus was never closed because there was an eternal war without. It is almost as true that there was an eternal revolution within. From the first plebeian riots to the last servile wars, the state that imposed peace on the world was never really at peace. The rulers were themselves rebels. There is a real relation between this religion in private and this revolution in public life. Stories, nonetheless heroic for being hackneyed, remind us that the Republic was founded on a tyrannicide that avenged an insult to a wife, that the tribunes of the people were re-established after another which avenged an insult to a daughter. The truth is that only men to whom the family is sacred will ever have a standard or a status by which to criticize the state. They alone can appeal to something more holy than the gods of the city, the gods of the hearth. That is why men are mystified in seeing that the same nations that are thought rigid in domesticity are also thought restless in politics, for instance, the Irish and the French. It is worthwhile to dwell on this domestic point because it is an exact example of what is meant here by the inside of history, like the inside of houses. Merely political histories of Rome may be right enough in saying that this or that was a cynical or cruel act of the Roman politicians. But the spirit that lifted Rome from beneath was the spirit of all the Romans. And it is not a cant to call it the ideal of Cincinnatus passing from the Senate to the plow. Men of that sort had strengthened their village on every side, had extended its victories already over Italians and even over Greeks, when they found themselves confronted with a war that changed the world. I have called it here the War of the Gods and Demons. There was established on the opposite coast of the inland sea a city that bore the name of the New Town. It was already much older, more powerful, and more prosperous than the Italian town. But there still remained about it an atmosphere that made the name not inappropriate. It had been called New because it was a colony like New York or New Zealand. It was an outpost or settlement of the energy and expansion of the great commercial cities of Tyre and Sidon. There was a note of the new countries and colonies about it, a confident and commercial outlook. It was fond of saying things that rang with a certain metallic assurance, as that nobody could wash his hands in the sea without the leave of the new town, for it depended almost entirely on the greatness of its ships, as did the two great ports and markets from which its people came. It brought from Tyre and Sidon a prodigious talent for trade and considerable experience of travel. It brought other things as well. In a previous chapter, I have hinted at something of the psychology that lies behind a certain type of religion. There was a tendency in those hungry for practical results, apart from poetical results, to call upon spirits of terror and compulsion, to move Acheron in despair of bending the gods. There was always a sort of dim idea that these darker powers will really do things, with no nonsense about it. In the interior psychology of the Punic peoples, this strange sort of pessimistic practicality had grown to great proportions. In the new town, which the Romans called Carthage, as in the parent cities of Phoenicia, the god that got things done bore the name of Moloch, who was perhaps identical with the other deity whom we know as Baal, the Lord. The Romans did not at first quite know what to call him or what to make of him. They had to go back to the grossest myth of Greek or Roman origins and compare him to Saturn devouring his children. But the worshippers of Moloch were not gross or primitive. They were members of a mature and polished civilization, abounding in refinements and luxuries. They were probably far more civilized than the Romans. And Moloch was not a myth, or at any rate his meal was not a myth. These highly civilized people really met together to invoke the blessings of heaven on their empire by throwing hundreds of their infants into a large furnace. We can only realize the combination by imagining a number of Manchester merchants with chimney pot hats and mutton chop whiskers going to church every Sunday at 11 o'clock to see a baby roasted alive. The first stages of the political or commercial quarrel can be followed in far too much detail, precisely because it is merely political or commercial. The Punic Wars looked at one time as if they would never end, and it is not easy to say when they ever began. The Greeks and the Sicilians had already been fighting vaguely on the European side against the African city. Carthage had defeated Greece and conquered Sicily. Carthage had also planted herself firmly in Spain. And between Spain and Sicily, the Latin city was contained and would have been crushed if the Romans had been of the sort to be easily crushed. Yet the interest of the story really consists in the fact that Rome was crushed. If there had not been certain moral elements as well as the material elements, the story would have ended where Carthage certainly thought it had ended. It is common enough to blame Rome for not making peace, but it was a true popular instinct that there could be no peace with that sort of people. It is common enough to blame the Roman for his delenda et Carthago. Carthage must be destroyed. It is commoner to forget that to all appearance, Rome itself was destroyed. The sacred savor that hung round Rome forever, it is too often forgotten, clung to her partly because she had risen suddenly from the dead. Carthage was an aristocracy, as are most of such mercantile states. The pressure of the rich on the poor was impersonal as well as irresistible, for such aristocracies never permit personal government, which is perhaps why this one was jealous of personal talent. But genius can turn up anywhere, even in a governing class. As if to make the world's supreme test as terrible as possible, it was ordained that one of the great houses of Carthage should produce a man who came out of those gilded palaces with all the energy and originality of Napoleon coming from nowhere. At the worst crisis of the war, Rome learned that Italy itself, by a military miracle, was invaded from the north. Hannibal, the grace of Baal, as his name ran in his own tongue, had dragged a ponderous chain of armaments over the starry solitudes of the Alps and pointed southward to the city which he had been pledged by all his dreadful gods to destroy. Hannibal marched down the road to Rome, and the Romans who rushed to war with him felt as if they were fighting with a magician. Two great armies sank to right and left of him into the swamps of the Trebia. More and more were sucked into the horrible whirlpool of Cannae. More and more went forth, only to fall in ruin at his touch. The supreme sign of all disasters, which his treason turned tribe after tribe against the falling cause of Rome, and still the unconquerable enemy rolled nearer and nearer to the city. And following their great leader, the swelling cosmopolitan army of Carthage passed like a pageant of the whole world. The elephants, shaking the earth like marching mountains, and the gigantic Gauls, with their barbaric panoply, and the dark Spaniards girt in gold, and the brown Numidians on their unbridled desert horses, wheeling and darting like hawks, and whole mobs of deserters and mercenaries and miscellaneous peoples, and the grace of Baal went before them. The Roman augurs and scribes, who said in that hour that it brought forth unearthly prodigies, that a child was born with the head of an elephant, or that stars fell down like hailstones, had a far more philosophical grasp of what had really happened than the modern historian, who can see nothing in it but a success of strategy concluding a rivalry in commerce. Something far different was felt at the time and on the spot, as it is always felt by those who experience a foreign atmosphere entering their own like a fog or a foul savor. It was no mere military defeat, it was certainly no mere mercantile rivalry that filled the Roman imagination with such hideous omens of nature herself becoming unnatural. It was Moloch upon the mountain of the Latins, looking with his appalling face across the plain. It was Baal, who trampled the vineyards with his feet of stone. It was the voice of Tanit, the invisible, behind her trailing veils, whispering of the love that is more horrible than hate. The burning of the Italian cornfields, the ruin of the Italian vines, were something more than actual. They were allegorical. They were the destruction of domestic and fruitful things, the withering of what was human before that inhumanity that is far beyond the human thing called cruelty. The household gods bowed low in darkness under their lowly roofs, and above them went the demons upon a wind from beyond all walls, blowing the trumpet of the tramontane. The door of the Alps was broken down, and in no vulgar but a very solemn sense it was hell let loose. The war of the gods and demons seemed already to have ended, and the gods were dead. The eagles were lost, the legions were broken, and in Rome nothing remained but honor and the cold courage of despair. In the whole world, one thing still threatened Carthage, and that was Carthage. There still remained the inner working of an element strong in all successful commercial states and the presence of a spirit that we know. There was still the solid sense and shrewdness of the men who managed big enterprises. There was still the advice of the best financial experts. There was still business government. There was still the broad and sane outlook of practical men of affairs. And in these things could the Romans hope. As the war trailed on to what seemed its tragic end, there grew gradually a faint and strange possibility that even now they might not hope in vain. The plain businessmen of Carthage, thinking as such men do in terms of living and dying races, saw clearly that Rome was not only dying but dead. The war was over. It was obviously hopeless for the Italian city to resist any longer, and inconceivable that anybody should resist when it was hopeless. Under these circumstances, another set of broad, sound business principles remained to be considered. Wars were waged with money, and consequently cost money. Perhaps they felt in their hearts, as do so many of their kind, that after all, war must be a little wicked because it costs money. The time had now come for peace, and still more for economy. The messages sent by Hannibal, from time to time asking for reinforcements, were a ridiculous anachronism. There were much more important things to attend to now. It might be true that some council or other had made a last dash to the Metaurus, had killed Hannibal's brother and flung his head with Latin fury into Hannibal's camp, and mad actions of that sort showed how utterly hopeless the Latins felt about their cause. But even excitable Latins could not be so mad as to cling to a lost cause forever. So argued the best financial experts, and tossed aside more and more letters full of rather queer alarmist reports. So argued and acted the great Carthaginian Empire. That meaningless prejudice, the curse of commercial states, that stupidity is in some way practical and the genius is in some way futile, led them to starve and abandon that great artist in the school of arms whom the gods had given them in vain. Why do men entertain this queer idea that what is sordid must always overthrow what is magnanimous? That there is some dim connection between brains and brutality, or that it does not matter if a man is dull so long as he is also mean? Why do they vaguely think of all chivalry as sentiment and all sentiment as weakness? They do it because they are, like all men, primarily inspired by religion. For them, as for all men, the first fact is their notion of the nature of things, their idea about what world they are living in. And it is their faith that the only ultimate thing is fear, and therefore that the very heart of the world is evil. They believe that death is stronger than life, and therefore dead things must be stronger than living things, whether those dead things are gold and iron and machinery, or rocks and rivers and forces of nature. It may sound fanciful to say that men we meet at tea tables or talk to at garden parties are secretly worshippers of Baal or Moloch, but this sort of commercial mind has its own cosmic vision. And it is the vision of Carthage. It has in it the brutal blunder that was the ruin of Carthage. The Punic power fell because there is in this materialism a mad indifference to real thought. By disbelieving in the soul, it comes to disbelieving in the mind. Being too practical to be moral, it denies what every practical soldier calls the morale of an army. It fancies that money will fight when men will no longer fight. So it was with the Punic merchant princes. Their religion was a religion of despair, even when their practical fortunes were hopeful. How could they understand that the Romans could hope even when their fortunes were hopeless? Their religion was a religion of force and fear. How could they understand that men can still despise fear even when they submit to force? Their philosophy of the world had weariness in its very heart above all. They were weary of warfare. How should they understand those who still wage war even when they are weary of it? In a word, how should they understand the mind of man who had so long bowed down before mindless things, money and brute force and gods who had the hearts of beasts? They awoke suddenly to the news that the embers they had disdained too much even to tread out were again breaking everywhere into flames. That Hasdrubal was defeated, that Hannibal was outnumbered, that Scipio had carried the war into Spain, that he had carried it into Africa. before the very gates of the Golden City, Hannibal fought his last fight for it and lost. And Carthage fell as nothing has fallen since Satan. The name of the new city remains only as a name. There is no stone of it left upon the sand. Another war was indeed waged before the final destruction, but the destruction was final. Only men digging in its deep foundation centuries after found a heap of hundreds of little skeletons, the holy relics of that religion. For Carthage fell because she was faithful to her own philosophy and had followed out to its logical conclusion her own vision of the universe. Moloch had eaten his children. The gods had risen again, and the demons had been defeated after all. But they had been defeated by the defeated and almost defeated by the dead. Nobody understands the romance of Rome and why she rose afterwards to a representative leadership that seemed almost fated and fundamentally natural, who does not keep in mind the agony of horror and humiliation through which she had continued to testify to the sanity that is the soul of Europe. She came to stand alone in the midst of an empire because she had once stood alone in the midst of a ruin and a waste. After that, all men knew in their hearts that she had been representative of mankind, even when she was rejected of men. And there fell on her the shadow from a shining and as yet invisible light, and the burden of things to be. It is not for us to guess in what manner or moment the mercy of God might, in any case, have rescued the world, but it is certain that the struggle which established Christendom would have been very different if there had been an empire of Carthage instead of an empire of Rome. We have to thank the patience of the Punic Wars if, in after ages, divine things descended at least upon human things and not inhuman. Europe evolved into its own vices and its own impotence, as will be suggested on another page. But the worst into which it evolved was not like what it had escaped. Can any man in his senses compare the great wooden doll, whom the children expected to eat a little bit of the dinner, with the great idol, who would have been expected to eat the children? That is the measure of how far the world went astray compared to how far it might have gone astray. If the Romans were ruthless, it was in a true sense to an enemy, and certainly not merely a rival. They remembered not trade routes and regulations, but the faces of sneering men, and hated the hateful soul of Carthage. And we owe them something if we never needed to cut down the groves of Venus exactly as men cut down the groves of Baal. We owe it partly to their harshness that our thoughts of our human past are not wholly harsh. If the passage from heathenry to Christianity was a bridge as well as a breach, we owe it to those who kept that heathenry human. If after all these ages we are in some sense at peace with paganism and can think more kindly of our fathers, it is well to remember the things that were and the things that might have been. For this reason alone, we can take lightly the load of antiquity and need not shudder at a nymph on a fountain or a cupid on a valentine. Laughter and sadness link us with things long passed away and remembered without dishonor, and we can see not altogether without tenderness the twilight sinking around the Sabine farm and hear the household gods rejoice when Catullus comes home to Sirmio. Deleta est Carthago.